Bloomberg Law with June Grosso. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app, iTunes, and on Bloomberg.com.
Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this Tuesday, October 4th. I'm June Grosso. The first week of the new Supreme Court term is focused on criminal cases. The first case of the term concerns a double jeopardy question in a political corruption prosecution in Puerto Rico that led to a very confusing verdict. One of the legal terms that most Americans are familiar with is double jeopardy. They've seen it on TV shows and movies like the thriller appropriately called Double Jeopardy. Ashley Judd is wrongfully imprisoned for murdering her husband, who's in hiding.
You ever hear of something called double jeopardy, Fifth Amendment to the Constitution? Huh? No? Well, double jeopardy provides that no person may be tried for the same crime twice. You got that? Keep staring. The state says you already killed your husband. They can't convict you of it a second time. That means that when you leave here, you track him down, and when you find him, you can kill him. That's right.
Actually, it's not right. Double jeopardy is a complicated legal concept often misunderstood by the public. Judd coming out of prison and shooting her husband would not constitute double jeopardy. The Supreme Court has addressed the complications of when double jeopardy attaches to a criminal charge many times, as it did in the first case of the term. It involved the alleged bribery of former Puerto Rico Senator Hector Martinez Maldonado by a prominent businessman. A jury found them guilty of bribery, but not guilty of conspiracy to commit bribery. The First Circuit Court of Appeals threw out the bribery convictions because the jury instructions were flawed, but found that the defendants could be retried. Now the Supreme Court will decide whether a retrial would be double jeopardy. My guests are Rory Little, a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, and Lisa Griffin, a professor at Pace University Law School. Rory, tell us more about the facts of this case of alleged bribery.
Well, it's a typical federal prosecution of state officials, of course not a state in Puerto Rico, but a businessman wanted some legislation enacted, and he went to a couple of state senators there and bought them some expensive tickets to a boxing match in Las Vegas and flew them out to Las Vegas, paid for hotel rooms, etc. This is all, of course, alleged because right now they've been acquitted on two counts and convicted on one. The feds indicted all three, but I think flipped one of the senators as a witness against the other one. And the jury surprisingly acquitted on two counts involving the claim of bribery and convicted on one. So when you say you can't be tried twice for the same offense, usually you can be if one of your convictions is thrown out. That is, the government tries you, you're convicted, appeal throws it out, you can come back and be retried on that count. The theory is it's all one continuing jeopardy. Here the question is, do the acquittals require that we believe the jury basically found that they didn't commit bribery so that they can't be tried on that one count that's been vacated because, in fact, the jury found they didn't commit bribery? It's a pretty complicated question. There's a couple of precedents from the Supreme Court on the topic, but they've never answered what happens when a conviction is vacated, and that's what they were spinning around on this morning.
Lisa, what is the defense argument that this is double jeopardy?
Well, the defense argument is based on an old case, Ashley Swenson, which says that the core protection of the double jeopardy clause is to prevent the government from retrying someone after an acquittal, and that the acquittals in this case, while they clearly would prevent retrying on the acquitted counts, also prevent retrying on the convicted count because the same facts were resolved. The jury basically found that they didn't commit the bribery, and therefore this should collaterally stop the government from bringing a retrial on the convicted count.
Rory, are these inconsistent verdicts? What did the prosecution argue?
You know, it's an interesting question. Are they inconsistent? Let's first be clear. The Supreme Court is going to assume they're inconsistent, whether they were or not. The government has conceded that they were inconsistent. Basically, there was a simple case. The argument here was that there was a bribery. That is, the businessman offered the senator something of value in return for some favorable action on legislation. Then the government threw in two more counts. You traveled to commit the bribery, and you conspired to commit the bribery. So really, it's three counts all focused on the same acts. So when they acquit on two counts, nobody disputed the travel. Nobody disputed the agreement, which is a conspiracy. The only thing disputed was it bribery or wasn't? So the argument here is the acquittal says they didn't commit bribery. The conviction says that they did. The complication is that the conviction was vacated. So the instructions, the jury got the wrong instructions on the conviction. So now the question is, can you rely on a vacated verdict to say anything about what the jury thought? This morning's argument seemed to be actually pretty one-sided almost on the government side here, which is surprising because there's a prior case called Yeager where the Supreme Court said you can't consider hung verdicts when the jury hangs and doesn't reach any decision. You just can't consider them.
We're talking about the first case of the Supreme Court term. It concerns a double jeopardy question in a political corruption prosecution in Puerto Rico that led to a very confusing verdict. And I've been talking to Rory Little, a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, and Lisa Griffin, a professor at Pace University Law School. Lisa, explain what a court has to find in order to decide that double jeopardy has attached.
Well, double jeopardy attaches when the jury is sworn in a jury trial, but what double jeopardy would prevent this retrial if there is a common issue that the acquittal decided in defendant's favor. And for example, if the government had brought the travel and conspiracy counts first and there had been an acquittal, then they could not have brought the bribery charge. That would have been clearly improper under the double jeopardy clause. The question now is, does the fact that there was a conviction that was vacated change that rule?
Rory, during the arguments, particularly Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that there were inconsistent verdicts and the jury might have decided that conviction on the bribery was enough and that the government had laid it on too strong by adding the conspiracy and the travel count. But she admitted we don't know what the jury was thinking. Do you have to know what the jury was? How do you decide what the jury was thinking when the jury just comes back with a guilty, not guilty, and there's inconsistencies?
Well, I mean, that's just a really good question. And your question, you could have been a justice because that's the same question they were asking this morning. And it kind of makes your head spin. Interestingly enough, both of the women who argued today for the defendant and for the government are former law clerks to Justice Ginsburg. So she had two of her sort of proteges up there arguing. Justice Ginsburg sort of asked the question, did the government overcharge the case here so that the acquittal on the two counts might not be that the jury necessarily decided they were innocent of bribery? They just didn't want to convict on three counts. They thought one was enough. The old cases say you have to decide what did the jury necessarily decide. And if they necessarily decided something that's essential to the remaining count, then you can't retry that count. The question really boils down to who has the burden to show it. Does the government have to show that it wasn't the same issue, or does the defendant have to show that it was? Because this vacated conviction kind of confuses us, and we don't really know what the jury ever was thinking. All they say is two words, not guilty, or they say one word, guilty. They don't tell us what they were thinking.
Lisa, in the National Association for Public Defense filed a brief in this case, an amicus brief, and said that, talked about the number of federal crimes exploding in recent years, and said the problem is not merely that prosecutors have a smorgasbord of offenses from which to choose, but that they're largely free to opt for all of the above from the buffet. Do you agree with that, that there are so many charges that the juries are dealing with now?
I do. It's clear that prosecutors can bring have totally open discretion about what charges they bring, and it's clear that they have a huge number of charges to choose from now that didn't exist when the double jeopardy clause was enacted, and the court may be sensitive to this because they've decided a couple of cases in which they've tried to restrict the government's arsenal in charging, and I think what they would say is, make your choice, and if you decide to just bring a lot of things and see what sticks, then you're going to have to deal with the consequences.
Now, Rory, tell us about the Powell case, because that case seemed odd to me. That government relied on that case heavily.
Well, yeah, the Supreme Court hasn't been all consistent on double jeopardy, and it's because the double jeopardy, as I always teach my students, is the worst written part of the entire Bill of Rights. It's ungrammatical, and if you wrote it in a law school exam, you would get a C or a D. The Powell case says that when the jury renders inconsistent verdicts together, convictions and acquittals, everything stands, even though they're logically inconsistent and really impossible, and that's just out of respect for the jury. And if they want to pick and choose, they can. So the Powell case says that. The Ash versus Swenson case, an older case, says when the jury necessarily decided an issue on some counts, you can't retry the other ones, or you can't try other ones that were never tried if it's the same fact at issue. So those two lines of cases might not be consistent. And interestingly, today, even though this would permit a second trial on this convicted count, most of the justices seem to be favoring the government's side here and saying, you know, shouldn't the government get one chance to take their conviction all the way to the finish line? This case won't come out probably until at least December or even after. And there's only eight justices, so they've got to decide it by five or it'll just be a tie.
Lisa, do you agree after looking at the oral arguments?
Well, I think Powell is misplaced in the sense that you really have to weigh the value we place on protecting acquittals. And I think that, sure, when a jury comes back and decides acquittal and conviction, we need to give voice to both of their statements. But here, it's a different balance. It's the balance of protecting acquittals against retrials versus a conviction that's already been vacated. So I think Powell is really not applicable when you're talking about successive prosecutions.
Do you agree that the justices seem to be skeptical of the double jeopardy argument?
Yes, I think they are. But I think it is an area in which the justices have been unbelievably confused. I don't think the fact that there are eight of them will make any difference because they've just really dealt with it as a 5-4, 4-5, 5-4 issue, as they try to construe this very tiny little phrase in the Bill of Rights.
Rory, is this an issue where the liberals would be on one side and the conservatives on another, or is it just a legal issue that has them all confused?
Well, you know, it has everybody a little bit confused. Not that they're confused, thinkers, but it's just a confusing area. I think it's really a case where your heart tugs one way and your head tugs the other way. You know, your heart wants to give voice to that acquittal and say the government shouldn't get a second shot when the only thing they were contesting was bribery, and on two of the counts they didn't win. The jury said no. That's the head position is, well, we don't really know what the jury thought, and they can't be retried on the two counts they acquitted on, but the government ought to be allowed to go all the way through to a solid jury verdict one way or the other on the other count. So, and that's kind of the head position. I think Justice Ginsburg surprisingly seemed to be favoring the government side here. And if she does, then that'll swing the balance towards the government in this case.
Lisa, what is the best argument the defense has?
The best argument the defense has, I think, is the one that Justice Kennedy sort of raised, which was if they had tried the travel and conspiracy counts first and there had been an acquittal, then that would have barred the prosecution of the bribery counts. I think their best argument is also that a vacated conviction has never had any legal effect historically, and that seemed to bother some of the justices. And I think that Powell is limited to the situation where the verdicts are rendered not to a successive prosecution case. And let me just point out that every double jeopardy case, because double jeopardy is designed to prevent government oppression, every double jeopardy case involves the government's right to go forward versus the defendant's right to avoid being oppressed by the government. So they've had trouble with it. They probably will have trouble with it, but we'll see what happens.
Anyone listening to the oral arguments or reading the transcripts can certainly see how confusing it is. Thank you both for helping to explain it. That's Rory Little, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, and Lisa Griffin, a professor at Pace University Law School. Thank you both for being on Bloomberg Law. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Law. We'll be back tomorrow and hope that you'll join us again. Thanks to our technical director, Jonathan Lauder, and our producer, David Sucherman. You can find more legal news at BloombergLaw.com and BloombergBNA.com, plus an invaluable website for the legal community at BigLawBusiness.com. Attorneys, you can find exceptional legal research and business development tools there as well. With All Due Respect is next for our Washington, D.C. audience, and Bloomberg Best is next for our listeners in New York, Boston, and San Francisco. I'm June Grosso. Have a great evening. You're listening to Bloomberg Law, and this is Bloomberg.
Listen to Bloomberg Law weekdays at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Washington on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2 Baltimore, in Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2, in San Francisco on 960 AM and 103.7 FM HD2, and Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2016 Bloomberg LP.